Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back, everyone. Bronson and Steve are here yet again. And Steve, we promised people last time we were going to talk about deer parasites and evidence of disease and more or less the common stuff hunters run across with a deer carcass. And nowadays they take a picture of it with their phone and they typically send it to somebody or put it on social media. And we see all sorts of explanations for these different parasites and lesions from diseases. So that is what today's episode is devoted to.
So should we kind of advise people don't be eating while you're listening to this podcast?
That's possible, but I think our audience, being that they're hunters and they like getting their hands in guts and skinning deer and preparing their own venison, I think they can handle it.
Okay, good deal.
Yeah, I think I can handle it. So you got to actually go hunting again a few days ago, is that right?
Yes, I had a really nice hunt Sunday afternoon. It was a great day to be in the woods, beautiful weather.
Is this a rifle hunt or a bow hunt?
Another bow hunt, yeah. Still have not loosed an arrow, but I've seen deer. Been seeing deer, and I've learned a few things along the line. You always learn something new when you go out.
Yeah, usually what not to do next time.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So, did you learn something not to do next time?
Well, now that you mention it, I learned that I probably don't need to be using my climbing tree stand anymore.
Why is that?
As you've pointed out so frequently, I'm older now than I used to be. And
everybody's older than they used to be.
That's true. That's a good thing. It's a good thing. But I think I've just gotten to that point where, I probably don't need to be shimmying up and down the tree. And, when I get up there, it wiggles a little bit. Your standing platform wiggles a little and I just don't need to do that anymore.
Okay, so you just don't feel comfortable doing it anymore.
Yeah.
All right.
And I didn't feel comfortable the day after when my muscles were sore from, I haven't been working my abs like I should. And
your one pack hurt a little bit?
Yeah. My one pack, I like that, yeah.
Okay, so allow me to retort. Two things. Number one, I can set you up with a system that will make your climbing stand rock solid. Okay. And I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's these straps that connect the bottom platform to the seat part. Mm-hmm. And it literally, I feel safer in my climbing stand than I do in a lock-on. I honestly do. So between my harness that's on my body, the base of the stand that, of course, is strapped around the tree once you get to the top, and you wrap your strap around the tree, and then the straps that connect the foot portion, the platform at the bottom, to the seat, it is as solid as any stand. And then I have one of those stands where that, around my waist, the rail that goes around, I don't have an open-faced climber. I have one of those rails that goes around me. And so I use that as well as the tension from my my safety harness.
Yeah.
And so with a bow, I feel completely comfortable leaning out over the platform and shooting. Mm-hmm. And I do not feel that way in most lock-on stands because it doesn't have the rail, you know, in front of me. So I love, you know, it's a pain sometimes hauling a climbing stand half a mile back into the woods. You know, it's certainly not as convenient, but I feel good about it. The second part about your one pack is if you hunted and climbed with it more, maybe by the end of the year you could go from a one pack to a two pack.
There you go.
And then you'd have that problem solved.
Okay, I will take that into consideration.
But I'm proud of you for still using your bow now that it's gun season here in Mississippi.
Yeah.
So you get some points for that.
You know, and you know, Sunday it was so beautiful out, and I was thinking, you know, if I had a gun, and I've killed lots of deer with gun that, you know, don't have a problem with it at all. Enjoy my rifle, and I enjoy my muzzleloader. I was just philosophizing on how nice it is for just the quietness of the bow. Mm-hmm. I was hearing some gunshots off in the distance, and you know, some guy half a mile away shooting was disrupting my serenity.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, you know, I can loose my bow and no one will know about it except for me and the deer.
Well, that's a very good point. If serenity is what you're after, then by all means. Yeah. And, you know, I opt for serenity and therapy till I get to the end of the year. And if I don't have at least three or four deer harvested and processed, then I go to disrupt someone else's serenity.
Yes.
With my rifle.
And this our listeners are going to wonder, what podcast am I listening to? Is this the Zen podcast or something? Let's transition from serenity and talk about deer parasites like you had mentioned.
To parasites that may make them lose their meal.
Yeah.
Well, one little announcement, though, Steve. A few episodes ago, we introduced our ebook, Strategic Harvest System, and we immediately, when we put that on Facebook, we had some people say, I don't do ebooks, and I sure wish you would develop a print copy of that. And so, as of a few days ago, that is now available. So now someone can go to Amazon and find our Strategic Harvest System. You can just search for that, and it will pop up. And now you have two options, an ebook, electronic version, or a print copy. That'll be mailed to them.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that.
I am too. I'm happy that project is done, and now we'll move on to the next project. Not in January, but sometime in 2018.
Yeah.
All right, the task at hand, parasites. Well, let's start with the most common. It doesn't have to be parasites. There are conditions that deer are going to have and hunters are going to run across. So do you want me to go down a list with you, Steve, of what I think are some of the most common ones, and I'll get your feedback?
Well, why don't we think about it from looking at the deer, the head. Okay, you've harvested your deer, whether mm-hmm. it's a doe or a buck, you want to, you know, you check out its head and appreciate the look of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
How about what might you see on the head or the neck?
Well, maybe antlers. What else?
Well, actually, relative to antlers, you know, if you have a malformed antler, mm-hmm. could be associated with a bacterial infection and an injury to the pedicle.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that might be an example of a disease if you're in an area that has the pathologic bacteria is associated mm-hmm. with, you know, spike on a side problems. Around the ears, oftentimes you'll see ticks. Fall and winter isn't a heavy tick load season. You'd be amazed at the number of ticks that deer have on them during the summertime. You know, I've counted, I've personally removed over 1,000 ticks from a deer.
Mm.
You know, it's pretty gross, actually, when it comes right down to the the number of ticks that can be on a deer, and there's different stages of ticks in the life cycle. There's the seed tick, the nymphs, and the adults, and you've got a mix of all those, and you know, dozens, hundreds, and like I said, even up to 1,000 ticks on a deer.
Has it ever been linked to mortality? Has a heavy tick load ever led, that you know of, to a deer dying? Or is this another one of those things we've talked about, that deer have lived and evolved with ticks for a long, long time and they can cope with it?
Well, there's a study way back when in Oklahoma that showed significant fawn mortality from too many ticks.
Okay.
So depending upon the stage of the life of the deer, they can be really serious.
And it seems like, I'm really exposing my ignorance here about ticks, but we hear from very, very reliable people that they've been to this area, a new area, and they say, I've never seen this many ticks, you know, in my life. Or from year to year. Man, I don't know what it is about this year, but man, we're seeing a lot of ticks. Can you speak to that at all? Do you have any experience with why those tick populations would vary so much?
Well, they're regulated by environmental circumstances. Most ticks are not just living on deer, they're living on other wildlife too. So depending upon the concentration of other wildlife species, it might affect the populations of ticks. There's been an increase, relatively speaking, in populations of deer tick in particularly urban areas where you have habitat conditions that favor small rodents and medium sized animals and deer living in a concentrated area, and you end up with increased populations of deer tick, and that's the tick that carries the bacteria that causes Lyme disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are areas that have more ticks now than they did, and it's related to habitat conditions and alternative hosts for ticks that oftentimes live on a couple different hosts.
You know what I bet Marcus Lashley would say?
Not enough burning.
Not enough burning. Has to have something to do with it. I have read some alternative perspectives on that, but I guess the jury may still be out. That in a couple studies, they actually saw no response, or I want to even say a greater response. But I don't know the time lag involved between when the burn occurred. You know, we don't know the intensity of the fire,
yeah,
per se. When
the
was it a cool, yeah, season fire, warm season fire, etc. So a lot of things you need to qualify that there. But I guarantee you fire would play a role.
Absolutely.
In the life cycle of those tick populations. Okay, so what about, Steve, the very first deer I killed happened to be a 6-point buck. I believe I was 16 years old. And I shot it, and I'm jumping for joy, and I go over there, and I roll it over. And the first thing that comes to mind is, oh my gosh, my first deer, the only deer I've ever killed, has got a big, fat, cancerous tumor growing out of the shoulder.
Yes. Kind of a big old black wart.
Yep, there was three of them. There was one really big one, and there was two or three others, you know, scattered on its leg and under his neck.
Yep, they can be as small as a pea, or as large as a golf ball, or even, you know, a flattened, like a big flat mushroom cap on growing off the side of a deer. Yeah, that's a virus caused by similar viruses to what cause warts on humans, and it, fancier name is Shope's fibroma. Shope is the guy that back in the 50s or 40s first described it, and so it was called Shope's fibroma. That in 50s, or that in 75 cents, or that in a dollar will get you a soda.
Or at Starbucks, that in $3.75 will get you a cup of coffee.
Yeah. But fibroma is fairly prevalent. You know, maybe one in 100, one in 150 deer in some areas, which is fairly prevalent. And I had a hunter come to my office about 2 weeks ago, and asking me to please help him. He just killed this deer that had all these lesions all over it, cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, was it okay to eat? And so I went out to the parking lot and looked at it, and it was a doe that had a whole bunch of fibromas on her.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a skin infection, so it doesn't affect the meat. Shouldn't be a problem to eat.
Yeah. So the way I explain it is, think of a wart on a human that's on the skin, and if you were to peel the skin back just like you peel the skin off a deer, that wart is attached to the skin and it's not attached to the meat.
That's right.
And so the meat is completely safe. And a lot of those will even fall off over time. Is that correct? I know not always, but a lot of times they will.
If they get, well, I don't know. I could see them falling off if they get big enough.
Mm-hmm.
But normally in those cases, there are more growing to take its place. So it's not okay. Like it. If a deer has a wart and you see one on camera, trail camera photo, it's that deer's going to have warts for the rest of its life.
Okay. And in terms of, is it harming the deer? It's only harming the deer when those things get so numerous or so massive that it impedes the deer's ability to eat, hear, smell, run from danger, etc.
That's right. And I've actually had hunters bring a couple to me over the years that were so massively covered with these things that there was actually bacterial infections associated with the fibroma, and the deer literally stunk from the secondary bacterial infection. That wasn't the fibroma, it was they were just so severe that it had secondary bacterial infections, and in those cases the deer was really poor conditioned, and I advised the hunter not to consume the meat.
Okay. But again, it wasn't caused by the fibroma.
No.
It was tissue, like the tissue from the fibroma rubbing against another one or something like that, an abrasion led to
secondary bacterial infections, and it was pretty nasty. But your run-of-the-mill fibroma, not a problem. Enjoy the venison.
All right, let's keep with, something I wanted to touch, Steve, while before we get too far from ticks. There's this other critter, depending on where you're at in the country and the time of year you harvest it. In the South, you would see this during bow season. You successfully harvest a deer, you roll it over on its back, you're ready to field dress it, and on the white belly fur, you see all these critters running around.
Yeah.
And you think, that my gosh, there is an infestation of ticks all over the belly.
Yep.
But actually,
they're called ked flies, and they're actually a member of the fly group of insects. And they're kind of cool in that they look like a crab. They kind of scamper, you know, across the belly, kind of in a sideways motion like a crab. That's the adult stage of the ked fly. That's the adult stage of the ked fly that you see. And they fly as adults. They have wings, and they fly onto the deer, and then they lose their wings once they've located their host, and they live on that host, eat skin secretions and such, and mate, and then continue the life cycle like any other fly. There's eggs, maggot, pupa, and then the adult.
So all the creepy crawlies that you see on a deer, some of them are ticks, some of them are flies.
Yeah, ticks are really slow.
Yeah.
If they're moving fast and scurrying around, that's a ked fly.
Okay, let's stay. Since you actually, I deviated a little bit there with your order of going from head to tail. So let's go back to the head. But now let's go inside the head.
Okay, and you were talking about flipping over your deer, you know, that first buck. I thought mm-hmm. you were going to say there was this big cancerous lump in its jaw. Mm-hmm. That's where I thought you were going with that story. So maybe we should talk about lumpy jaw.
Yep, and there's another one. besides Lumpy Jaw. That now when you don't have the deer on its back on the ground, but when you hang the deer up.
Yes.
A little something else. Okay, let's go with Lumpy Jaw. So it looks like you might say, if let's just say you didn't see the deer, you didn't see this occurring, you know, this Lumpy Jaw, you just shot it. And you get over there, and this happened to me before, and you see in the mouth, it looks like, oh my gosh, this deer must have been chewing its cud. A really, really big cud. It was so big that it actually pushed down between the mandible and the skin and the jaw, way down in there.
Mm-hmm. The jawbone, between the jawbone and the cheek.
Yeah, between the jawbone and the cheek. But actually, it wasn't just chewing its cud. That's an impaction.
Yes.
Food that have been there.
Yeah.
So why is that?
Well, it's food impaction is the perfect way to describe it. But it's an injury to the inside of the jaw, you know, of the skin inside the mouth. And what happens is an arterial worm, a nematode, that gets in the arteries of the deer up around the jaw, and it basically clogs the artery because there's not good blood supply to that tissue. Tissue kind of degrades, and it gets, you know, just kind of falls apart inside the mouth. And so as the deer is chewing its vegetation and then swallowing it and belching it back up to chew, you know, the vegetation just gets kind of wedged in its cheek, and it just gets more and more. And literally, I've pulled out enough of an impaction to, if you'd imagine the size of a soft, a baseball.
Mm-hmm.
If you wadded it up, it would be the size of a baseball. It was just wedged down into literally a hole between the jawbone and the cheek.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, because of the lack of blood flow, that tissue is kind of deadening or necrosing.
Necrotic is a good word.
Yeah.
And, it might not be a good word for our listeners, but necrotic is the good descriptive word.
It's dying.
Yes.
That little tissue is dying. Okay. Yes, I see you nodding your head. Did you want to?
Well, and then I'm jumping, you know, sometimes I'm ADHD, I jump around a lot, but I was transitioning to the other head-related parasite that you'd mentioned earlier. When you take your deer home to skin or process, you hang it upside down, and you know maybe you've already gutted it, and you're letting it just cool down a little bit, and then you see these big old maggots crawling around.
Giant magnets.
Yeah,
magnets. Maggots.
Yes.
I always tell, they look like grubs. They're so big. Like if you ever work in the yard, and especially in the forest, you know, those big old white grubs you'll see wiggling around?
Yeah.
That's kind of what they look like.
Yeah, now the grubs in the soil are actual beetle larvae.
Mm-hmm.
Now these are actually fly larvae. And if you imagine, you know, I know you've done it. I've done it. Most every outdoor type person has done it. You find a roadkill or a dead animal, you flip it over, and there's maggots, fly maggots. Or maybe, you know, in your trash can, outside trash can, you get some fly maggots. You know, imagine that fly maggot that you see on steroids. It's, you know, 10, 15 times as large. These things can be an inch long maggot. So they're basically a bot fly. The fly, the adult fly, will fly up and literally lay eggs on the face or the body of the deer. And the deer will then lick the eggs, and the eggs will hatch pretty quickly. And the larvae, the very small larvae, will just migrate to the back of the mouth, top of the throat, back of the mouth.
And in the sinus cavities, won't they migrate up to the sinus cavities?
Yes. There's a area in the back of the mouth and up into the sinuses that is occupied by these by the bot flies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you squirrel hunt, you may have come across bot flies in squirrels. People call them wolves.
Warbles,
yeah, same thing. It's the larvae stage of a fly where they live in the animal, and then they'll come out when they're fully matured. They'll fall to the ground, and then they'll develop into what we call a pupa. Mm-hmm. They pupate like that, and then they come out of their pupa, and you know, male and female fly find each other, and then the female goes off and lays its eggs.
And the cycle begins again.
Yeah. And I've seen deer kind of jumping around and acting kind of weird and running. They'll just start running around, and you know, I've seen it on food plots in particular where, you know, you're watching deer for a while. And I wonder if maybe there's a bot fly that's trying to lay eggs on it, and mm-hmm. it realizes, oh, this is not a good thing, and it's trying to avoid the bot fly.
I've seen that one time as well. I may have seen it a lot of times, but there was one in particular that I thought, I bet that is what's going on, because it was a, it actually did like a mule kick. It was a single deer. It was actually a doe not far, 70 yards away, and I'm watching her, and started going crazy, running around and kicking with her back feet and slinging her head all around, and I thought, I bet that is a bot fly trying to lay some eggs mm-hmm. on her face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she finally just ran off the food plot and into the woods. I hope she made it.
Yeah.
Hope she evaded the bot fly.
And sounds like she evaded your harvest.
She evaded me as well. That's right. Okay. So, what about now we're gutting the deer and we're pulling the liver out. And as we pull the liver out, we see these masses look maybe like a cyst or something, but it's not just this nice, smooth, reddish, maroonish liver. There's all these little, what appear to be cysts. What is that?
Yeah,
that,
those are liver flukes. And they're a really interesting fluke. they have a life cycle that involves a stage that lives in snails. And so you tend to only have these in deer where there's wetter areas that support snail populations. But where they're in those like bottomland areas, wetland areas, the deer will often have liver flukes. And you'll see it like a cloudy little size of a quarter, kind of a whitish, grayish area on the liver. And if you cut down in there, you will find two liver flukes. And a liver fluke is, well, it's about an inch to an inch and a half long and about mm-hmm. an inch wide. And there's usually two. There's a male and female. They cohabitate in a little spot. And that's they live together in that tiny little spot. And female lays eggs, and it gets the eggs get distributed out through the bile and into the intestines and go out through the feces and carry its life cycle on, getting eventually to the snails. Snails get on the vegetation, get eaten by the deer. Deer gets that next stage, which then comes back into a deer and occupies its liver.
So is this similar to a lot of parasites where no big deal if they have one or two of them, but would it be possible they could have enough of them that it would jeopardize the health of the deer?
I've rarely seen deer that I was worried about from based on how many liver flukes they had.
Okay.
There may be some wildlife pathologists somewhere that have seen really serious cases, but not a big concern. The okay. liver is really a very remarkably functional organ within an animal's body, and they can deal with some damage from liver flukes.
Okay.
I wouldn't eat the liver flukes.
Make a nice little hors d'oeuvre, though, you know, it's good.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what you could do, though? You could take one of those, take the male and the female, put a toothpick through it, wrap it in bacon.
Oh, yeah.
That'd make a great little grill hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah, or put it in a jalapeno.
A jalapeno popper with a liver fluke.
We are being really gross.
Serve
now.
That to somebody you don't like.
Yeah.
How about that?
Okay. Disclaimer, we don't recommend actually doing that. We're just joking.
Just kidding. Okay, so now the knife slips a little bit, Steve. You know, it's always a slip when you cut the rumen, unless you're being an investigator and you want to figure out what the deer is eating, which we as wildlife biologists always recommend, mm-hmm. getting your hands in the guts, in the rumen. You cut open an intestine,
mm-hmm.
and not only is the usual suspect feces within the intestine, but you see some other little creepy crawlies in there.
Yeah, and you know, occasionally you'll see tapeworms in a deer, but not a lot of deer have tapeworms. But most deer will have some number of nematodes or scarids. In fact, just recently we heard about the North Korean defector, the army defector
yeah.
that was shot crossing into South Korea, and I saw an article about these big nematode worms that were in his intestines. And you know, deer don't have big 10-inch long worms in their intestines, but they have similar worms, and healthy deer might have 10 or 20. And they're much smaller, diameter of a hair,
mm-hmm.
or even smaller than that. But it's not unusual to have some of these worms in deer. But most hunters, you know, if you slip and cut the intestines, you're not really going to see those worms because they're not big enough.
I just thought of, I literally, Steve, as you said that, just thought of something. I too saw on the news a week ago or whenever it was, and I was taken back, you know, looking at the size of that that worm that was in that poor fellow's stomach or intestines. Why did they do an autopsy to, were they looking for worms? What was the point of that defector?
Well, I think he'd been shot like 6 or 7 times, and they were doing surgery on him. And
oh, they encountered it while they were doing surgery?
I think.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if his intestines were perforated by one of the bullets.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense. And Steve, there's probably, I know, you've got a book beside you that's about 2 inches thick with all sorts of diseases and parasites, and we could go on and on and on, but we're really hitting the top 10, and I don't know if we're doing 10. It might be the top 7 we're going through, but these are the most common. What about when you get down, let's say you're hanging your deer up again, and you notice something is wrong with its foot. It appears that the hoof has become detached from the foot.
Yeah.
What's going on with that?
Okay. The hoof damage is caused by a high fever. And the high fever would have been caused by something like epizootic hemorrhagic disease or blue tongue. And so when a deer typically gets that late summer, early fall, they'll be really sick and just basically flu-like symptoms on, you know, only worse. And many of them die at that point, but it, you know, if they don't die then, they'll recover from that, but they'll have hoof damage because of the high high fever affects the ability to grow hoof material. Just like if you get a really high fever, you'll notice in your, as your fingernails and toenails grow out, you know, a week or 3 weeks or 4 weeks later, you'll see some disrupted growth, almost like roughness,
mm-hmm.
and that's because of that fever disrupting your fingernail and toenail growth. And so imagine a deer that has an extremely high fever, isn't treated symptomatically, and literally has hooves that are damaged from that. And so oftentimes in hunters harvest deer, they're seeing hoof damage that's recovered hoof.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have sloughed completely, or you know, they just disrupted the growth, and so they don't look normal. They don't have that blackish shiny
yeah.
look to them that a normal hoof would have.
And so every year, Steve, so let's clarify a few things. So what's the difference? Why did you specify epizootic hemorrhagic disease or EHD and blue tongue? Aren't they very similar?
Very similar, yeah.
They're transmitted the same way?
Yes,
same. And how are they transmitted?
Same viral disease group, hemorrhagic disease, but and they're transmitted by a biting midge, a small biting fly.
Most people would say a gnat.
A gnat.
In my neck of the woods, we'd say a gnat.
Yes, a gnat. But there's different serotypes, different varieties of the virus, and blue tongue is historically was described in domestic livestock and tends to be, you know, those serotypes, those varieties of the virus are called blue tongue, and then the epizootic hemorrhagic disease are those varieties that were originally, I think, described in wild animals, and that's why they call it epizootic, because mm-hmm. it's a disease associated with wild animals.
So it's hemorrhagic disease. Are they hemorrhaging to death with the acute form?
Well, yes, it can. Well, yes, it causes hemorrhaging within the body,
mm-hmm.
and that's why they call it hemorrhagic disease. It's symptomatic.
And they are often, so when a hunter encounters, let's say, one that died from EHD or blue tongue, they often encounter them near a water source.
Yes.
Tie that back to the hoof sloughing.
Well, okay, a couple things. Well, all the way back to why did the hoof slough?
Mm-hmm.
High fever.
High fever.
Okay, so you have a high fever, you don't feel good, your hooves are hurting, what do you do if you get a really bad case of the flu? Where do you spend the day?
Hopefully at the doctor's office.
Well, after you get back from the doctor's office, where do you go? Do you go out and cut the grass?
Well, I go work out. I typically throw up, you know, 200 or 300 pounds on the bench press, and then I go get on the couch.
Yeah,
you don't ride it out on the couch. Yeah.
Achy muscles. Mm-hmm. Everything hurts when you have a bad flu case. Well, that's basically what these deer have when they have hemorrhagic disease. So they don't want to go anywhere, but they have to drink water. And so they go in, get near water, and then they get out of the water just barely, and they literally sit down next to the water because that's as far as they want to go. And oftentimes they die there.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going to die, they'll die at the water, and that's where you tend to find mm-hmm. animals that have died from EHD or hemorrhagic disease.
Okay, Steve, like we said earlier, there's more. There are more things going on. There are more parasites we didn't cover and more diseases we didn't cover, but I think we've hit probably 90% of what a hunter would encounter.
Yes.
If you're going to encounter something, it's going to be mostly the ones we mentioned. But there's
just occurred to me.
Oh.
In fact, just recently got a trail camera photo sent of a deer that its hide looked strange.
Mm-hmm.
And we get these periodically from people. And those are always really difficult to diagnose from a photo. They could be a viral, it could be genetic problems. There's a lot of different problems associated that could cause skin, hair loss.
Well, usually in those emails, it's, does this deer have the mange?
Yeah.
You know, that's usually what we hear.
Yeah. And without getting a skin sample, a scraping sample that could be evaluated, it's almost impossible to tell what's really wrong with the skin of that deer, of the hide, what's causing the hair loss.
Would you can, you know, never say never and never say always, and it depends. In your typical scenario with a skin issue like that, would you advise a hunter that finds a deer, they shot the deer and they get up on it and like, ooh, boy, this is weird. There's hair missing and something doesn't look right. Do they consume that deer or dispose of that deer?
I would suggest they call their conservation officer or game warden mm-hmm. and describe it, or text the officer a photo of it and get their input.
Okay.
You got to be careful, you know, you don't want to be fined or written up for improperly, you know, not consuming something that you harvest.
Yeah.
And it might be something that they need to know about.
Mm-hmm.
So I would start with a call to the game warden and get their input.
I want to close, Steve, with something that happens at 99% of our seminars, when you talk about these parasites, diseases, and conditions. Someone thoughtfully so will raise their hand and say, first they'll say, is there anything I can feed or do to minimize these types of parasites and diseases on my property?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it depends. Mm-hmm. If you are artificially concentrating deer, you will increase the concentration of diseases and parasites in the deer. It's almost guaranteed.
No way around it.
Almost no way around it. Mm-hmm. If you are supplementally feeding, you can expect to have higher parasites. Now, if you're supplementally feeding, you can also buy some treated feed that will help control internal parasites. We do that in our deer pens. We treat for internal parasites and external parasites. It's not something that the deer like. They don't consume the treated feed as well. So if you put out treated feed, you're going to actually probably see a decrease in consumption rate. But if you're feeding and you have some parasite problems, you might need to do that. You could check to see if you have a parasite problem by collecting some samples of, you know, maybe 5 or 10 different separate, unique piles of feces, and keeping them separate, take them to a vet and say, all right, I want to know, generally, do I have a worm or a parasite, internal parasite problem in my deer? And they can do a fecal flotation, or, you know, same as they would do for your dog or cat. They'll test to see what kind of egg load is in your feces, and then mm-hmm. from that they can tell, you know, what kind of parasites are in the intestines and relative numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that vet might then say, yeah, you've got some pretty heavy parasites here, and you might want to consider some treated feed. But back to my central point there, anytime you artificially concentrate animals, you're going to increase the probability of parasites and diseases. So the best thing you can do to keep your animals healthy is to keep them distributed across the habitat by having good, effective habitat management. Do some prescribed burning to minimize the tick populations. And that same kind of a habitat management is going to distribute food across the habitat, across your property, so you're not concentrating deer.
So to that point, what about just general deer density? Do we ever see a deer density effect?
Yes.
Of parasites when numbers are too high?
Yes, because when you concentrate deer, same thing. If you have too many deer or concentrating them artificially, it's the same thing. You got greater chance of spreading a disease when you're closer to another individual.
Okay. So bottom line, we kind of get back to good old common sense, right? Where if numbers are kept at appropriate levels and the habitat is managed, the deer are in good condition. So when they're faced with a virus or a bacteria, a well-conditioned, well-fed, well-conditioned deer is going to be better able to deal with that.
That's right.
Physiologically. And everything is going to work out.
Yes, good habitat management, good population management. Deer have been living with parasites for eons. A few, not a problem. It's when you get artificially high numbers of deer that concentrate and get artificially high numbers of parasites, and that's when they're problematic.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve. Imparting your wisdom upon us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, as always, to share what little I've known and what I've learned.
Yeah. You are nice. The little that you have, you're nice to be able to share it with so many.
I will share it, yes.
Anything? Yeah?
Well, Thanksgiving. We just had Thanksgiving, and this is, you know, maybe would have been more fitting for last week if mm-hmm. we were talking about this specifically last Thursday, but I'm so thankful for the opportunity to work with you and to do things like this podcast and our workshops and our new book on buck management strategies. And I'm going to continue to be thankful going into Christmas holidays and for our Jewish listeners, Hanukkah and you know, all of our wonderful opportunities for family time, spending more time outdoors, and just, well, we got a lot to be thankful for.
A lot to appreciate. That's exactly right. Well, I appreciate you as well, Steve.
Okay. Now, I didn't say that just so that you could say it to me.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of obligated to now,
yeah,
right? You kind of put me on the spot.
You had to,
yeah.
Sorry.
No. Of course, you and everybody I tell, I'm grateful and thankful for the opportunity we have here at Mississippi State at the Deer Lab, and we have a wonderful time in our outreach and with our research, and it's a perfect job for me and a perfect job for you. So,
absolutely.
So I'll tell you what, Steve, with that, I think we'll sign off right here, and maybe next time we record, we can tell some stories of a successful deer hunt. Not just the hunt, but maybe
the harvest.
Yeah. The harvest to go along with it, yeah.
Good deal.
All right. Well, good luck, Steve.
Same to you, Bronson.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next time.
We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.